I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, or KBOO.fm if you're listening online. And wherever you are, it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, KBOO's magazine of socialist and feminist analysis of politics and culture. I'm your host for today, Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Joe Clement. We'll be talking to you soon about how you can support this show and this radio station. But first, we're going to get started with our first interview on the show, Robert McChesney. Later on, we'll hear from Chicago-based writer, activist, and academic and commentator Yasmin Nair on queer critiques of gay marriage and of inclusion and equality and so forth. Towards the end of the show, our movie moles will be discussing Oliver Stone's new movie, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. But first to Bob McChesney, the author of several widely read books on democracy and the media. Recently, he and John Bellamy Foster discussed in Monthly Review the causes of the ongoing economic crisis and the role of financialization. They pointed out that if the Great Recession has leveled off before plunging into the depths of a second Great Depression, it has nonetheless left the U.S. and world economies in shambles. Official U.S. unemployment is over 9%, while real unemployment, taking into account all of those wanting jobs plus part-timers desiring full-time work, is close to twice that, so close to 18%. Well, last week, Bill Resnick talked with Bob McChesney, and he started by asking him to define financialization and to explain what role it had in causing the Great Recession.
Sure. Financialization refers to the process by which, in our economy today, a much larger portion of economic activity, of profits, is being generated in the credit sector by banks, by insurance companies, and even in real estate. That's really part of the process. And that what we see is a massive increase in what's considered speculation and the driving up of asset values, while the actual real economy of goods and services plays a smaller role in the economy. And one way that financialization always works is what the other side of financialization is a huge increase in debt in an economy relative to the real economy. So debt is a percentage of gross domestic product. All types of debt, but especially private and personal debt in the last 30 years, increased dramatically because increased financialization is increased speculation and increased debt. Yeah, a lot of people argue that financialization is the cause of our problems. It's led to this massive speculative bubble of asset prices that were grotesquely overpriced, and that when they burst, as they did in 2007 and 2008, it drags down the entire economy, much like it did in the Great Depression. And that had we not pursued the financialization course, had that not become such a big part of capitalism starting in the 1980s and through to the present day, we wouldn't have had this crisis and everything would be fine. We'd be back with the good old days of the golden age of capitalism. Our argument, and I think the evidence is incontrovertible here, is that that's nonsense, that financialization was not like some disease that came along and corrupted an otherwise healthy and vibrant capitalist economy. Instead, financialization was a response to the stagnation and crisis of capitalism of the 70s. And I think that listeners who are our age, Bill, will remember that starting in the early 1970s and throughout that decade, it was a decade in which the capitalist economy was in the darkest moments it had faced since the 1930s. And there was a combination of massive inflation, price inflation on one hand, with high unemployment and stagnant growth. And the traditional toolkits governments had used to address those problems since the 1940s, and addressed them fairly successfully, I might add, were no longer working. It simply wasn't happening. And the fear at that time, and I think a legitimate fear, was that capitalism was about to enter a period of very slow growth, high unemployment, uncertainty, with probably not good political consequences for those that sit atop a capitalist society. And financialization was the way out of that problem. By dramatically increasing debt, it was able to keep the economy growing at a much higher clip than would have been the case otherwise. And I think that explains much of the economic growth of the past 25 years has come through this huge increase in debt and speculation, which has also meant that while you've had sort of a degree of economic growth, Bill, what we've seen is the other side of the coin, which is we've had a massive increase of inequality, that we've seen that real wages for the great bulk of Americans have barely increased in the last 30 years. And the almost all the economic income growth in our economy since 1980 has gone to the top 10% of the population. And within that, the vast majority has gone to the top 1% or even 0.1%. So financialization has, in fact, while it saved the economy to a certain extent, it also exacerbated problems and made them much larger, put us in the situation we're in today, where the future of capitalism, by any sane account, is a grim one.
Let's talk about sort of the origins of it. I mean, there's always been a big financial sector, and in fact, it's necessary to keep moving the money around and creating some debt so that the economy can keep growing. It seems to me in the 70s, though, during the stagnation, rich people were still getting rich. There was vast amounts of money being made, and particularly by the oil powers, but many other people were getting very rich, but there was nothing to invest in. There was no point in building another auto plant or, in fact, doing many things because there just wasn't sort of demand for it. And that money had to go somewhere, and the banks had to figure out how do we attract that money and, in fact, then give returns on it. And it seems to me that was part of the sort of the mechanism through which financialization grew and grew and kept growing because the rich kept getting richer doing these manipulative things and creating this debt. And so it just kept going. What do you think of that hypothesis?
Well, if that's a true-false question, the answer is true. You're absolutely right. Your analysis is dead on. You know, I think what I would add to that is that this sort of permanent crisis of modern capitalism is the inability to find investment outlets to invest capital, which leads to capital sitting on the sidelines or going into speculation, workers being unemployed, and it exacerbates the problem, becomes a downward spiral. And this was the issue that was faced in the 1970s, and it's the issue we face very much today. It's the central crisis, or Marxist theorists call contradiction of capitalism. And what happened, but to put it in some context, financialization or finance always plays an important role in any economy, frankly, but certainly a capitalist economy, because its job is to channel the savings of society to productive investment outlets. So all the people who save put their money in the financial system, and the financial system allocates it to the most theoretically allocates it to the most useful investment uses. So it's a very necessary function in any economy. But what happens in a capitalist economy is that there's tremendous temptation by capitalists, by investors, and people wanting to get rich, to use the financial system and speculation to get rich really quickly without actually having to build a factory or hire workers through shuffling paper. And this temptation increases dramatically when there are fewer real investment opportunities out there. And this is one of the major factors, Bill, that led to the Great Depression and the huge financial collapse of 1929, 30, 31. It was a result of that in the late 30s and 1940s, the United States and most of the countries of the world installed very strict restrictions on the financial sector to prevent there ever being another financial meltdown that would drag down the real economy. And all these measures that were put in place in the 1940s, led by John Maynard Keynes, the brilliant economist who was a ferocious foe of financialization and debt and the credit system, these measures that were put in place kept us from having any financial problems at all into the 70s. The economy, capitalist economy of the world from the 40s to 70s barely had any financial meltdowns or bubbles. And it was tremendous pressure from Wall Street, from the financial sector, that led to the great relaxation of all sorts of financial regulations, starting in the 70s and through the 80s and 90s, to the point that by the end of the 90s, we barely had any regulations of any meaning yet. And the entire financial sector had grown exponentially, dramatically, with all sorts of new crazy debt instruments that no one even really understood, and created this massive swelling of debt and speculation.
Yeah, all
had to plummet.
Right, all soaking up wealth, though. In fact, all of that, there really was real wealth went into these things, and during the collapse, it ended. And all of those resources that it represented could have been used for other purposes, that is, for restoring the environment, for creating better educational systems, for all of the needs that, for, in fact, rebuilding the infrastructure of the U.S. that's crumbling. It seems to me that that's one cost. Another cost, it seems to me, is that once the financiers take over going enterprises, I mean, some of these corporations and the companies and businesses are, in fact, producing things that are necessary. But once they take over, they milk the companies for the profits. That is, financial people take over rather than production people. It seems to me those processes have to then, financialization is really a poison on an economy once it gets
in. Well, again, if that's a true false question, Bill, I'm going to give you another true.
Oh, good. I'm.
You're two for two. I think you're absolutely right. And I think the real question for us as Americans and as citizens of the world, and the really important debate that needs to be had, is can we reform capitalism? Can we take our currently existing economic system and can, through reforms, through regulation of the financial sector, through aggressive public spending of the Keynesian variety in infrastructure, in education, in health care, in transportation and communication, in green jobs, can you still have an economy that's driven by people seeking profit, large corporations and wealthy individuals driving the process, and have a healthy, vibrant economy that can live at peace with the environment and have a future? And that's the great debate. I think on one side are the liberals and the Keynesians, Paul Krugman, Joe Stiglitz, Jamie Galbraith, who argue that, you know, indeed capitalism is in a deep crisis and has some serious problems, but you can keep the best of capitalism, the free market, which they like, with all sorts of Keynesian solutions. And the other side of the coin are people like myself and John Foster, who think that, on one hand, the political willpower to do that in our corrupt political system is going to be extraordinarily difficult to win those reforms. But capitalism is so driven by the profit system that even those reforms, if you somehow could implement them, would eventually butt up against the needs of the owners to make profit, and they would produce all sorts of other problems. The system itself is got inherent flaws in it. And really, if there's going to be a solution for us as a species, we've got to somehow get past this economic system at some point, or we're going to face problems we don't want to face.
Yeah, I'll give you a true for that. There seems to be another side of it, though, as well, that even if we were able to restore the system as it existed in the 60s and early 70s and high growth processes, what we run into is global warming and other environmental threats. It just, a system of exponential growth, which is capitalism, and under financialization is the extreme of it, as it runs out of investment, you know, very profitable investments. It seems to me a system of exponential growth is ultimately going to, in fact, exhaust all of our ecosystems and poison all of us. It seems to me that what we can see is that the days of this system are numbered, but maybe our days are numbered unless we organize to, in fact, change the way we use our wealth.
Well, you know, Frederick Jameson famously said that it's easier for most people to think of the extinction of our species, the end of humanity, than it is for them to think of the end of capitalism. And I think that very much captures the dilemma we face now, which is, you're right, the way capitalism worked, needing compound annual growth rate of, say, 3% annually to really survive and be a credible system, that's what it needs. The ability to do that effectively, even taking out the environmental factor altogether, just even worry about the environment, say that's not a factor at all, the ability to do that right now looks virtually impossible for the visible future. If you study capitalism and how it grows, it just doesn't. That's just not in the cards. Then you put in the environmental cost and damage that such growth entails, or even lower growth entails, and it becomes frankly absurd. So, what we need to have is a pretty candid conversation about whether this economy is going to be is really satisfactory. I think that's a conversation, regrettably, that the people who run our society, who benefit by the status quo, are in no hurry to encourage whatsoever, but that only redoubles the need for all of us to work at that issue.
You know, Bob, let me have the last word. Thanks so much for talking to us. And the last word is, let me see if I get a three for three on true or falses. is that one thing that has happened over the last 100 years is we've developed the technologies, actually, and the capacity, technologies both social and productive. That is, we can live together to create a very, very different steady-state economy in which everybody can live comfortably. For example, in the energy sector, we really could live on sun and wind energy quite well without polluting. And it's true in agriculture, too. There are all of the possibilities are there, and we know how to set up cooperative kinds of production and democratic societies, although they're very difficult. It's not the technology at all. It's not the know-how. It's all politics now. True or false?
True again. You're really on a roll.
I know. I'm 3 for 3. That's what you call batting 1,000. You too, Bob. Thank you very much for talking.
My great pleasure. Good luck to everyone out in Portland.
Thanks a lot.
And you are tuned to KBOO, where you just heard author and media critic Bob McChesney talking to the Old Mole's Bill Resnick here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. You know, McChesney's a big supporter of KBOO, and I'd like you to hear what he says about why it's important for you to support this listener-supported station.
Hi, this is Bob McChesney. I'm calling you, talking to you today from the Midwest. I travel the country all the time, and one of the things I've noticed in every city I go to is the quality of the local media, especially the community radio station. One of the great thrills whenever I go to Portland is getting to listen to KBOO, to meet the people who work at the station, to talk to people in the community and see how they relate to the station. And it is an oasis, literally, in a desert in the media system of Oregon and in this country. You're very privileged to have a station like KBOO. And I can tell you, as one who's lived in cities without a station like KBOO, if you ever lose a station like that, you'd pay anything to get it back. So you've got it right now. Don't take it for granted. Give it all the support you possibly can. We can build a much better country and a much better media system, but we need all hands on deck. It starts with you. Contribute and support KBOO.
Next up on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the Old Mole's Denise Morris is here in the studio to talk with Yasmin Nair, who has participated in and helped edit a book called Against Equality, Queer Critiques of Gay Marriage. So they'll be talking about the politics of inclusion. Denise.
Thank you, Clayton. Good morning. Yasmin, are you on the line?
Yes. Hi, Denise.
Great. Thanks for joining us. Yasmin Nair, you are a Chicago-based writer, activist, and academic, and commentator. And to your credit, you've got loads of critical essays, book reviews, investigative journalism, op-eds, and much of this work can actually be found in print as well as online in publications like The Progressive, Makeshift, Windy City Times, Bitch Magazine, and No More Potlucks, one of my favoritely titled publications.
Yeah,
and in your writing and organizing, you're tackling issues like neoliberalism, a small issue like neoliberalism, inequality, queer politics, the politics of rescue and sex trafficking. You're writing about the art world currently, and organizing and writing around the immigration crisis and public education. So you're pretty busy, and we thank you for taking the time out to join us this morning on the Old Mole.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, as Clayton said in the introduction, we're here to talk about a new publication, Against Equality, Queer Critiques of Gay Marriage. But this particular publication comes out of an online archive, and that's the Against Equality Archive Collective, and you're a part of that. I wanted to have you talk a little bit to folks about what that is. That archive has been dedicated to queer challenges of the politics of inclusion. And I wanted to have you talk about its importance in the battle of pushing back against these kind of increasingly conservative politics driving the mainstream gay rights movement currently.
Right, sure. Right. The archive actually began as a project by Ryan Conrad, the founder of the collective, sometime in October 2009. And then he and I and a few other people got together and said, you know, we want to broaden this to... at first, our concern was with the conservatives of the gay marriage movement, which essentially, to reduce everything down, you know, just for the sake of this conversation, which essentially argues that marriage should be the guarantor of basic benefits like health care. And it also then wraps itself up in other kinds of conservative logic, which is to say, you know, married people are basically better than other people. There are these 1,000 benefits that married people get that gay people should get as well, rather than continuing what had been a predominant theme in the gay movement until about the 80s, which was to say, you know, gay people, queer people are different, and we can actually articulate a better, more radical politics. We demand universal health care, right? So queers got out of the health care conversation sometime in the 90s and then went on to push for a very conservative agenda for gay marriage. So that was a concern for us, and it's been getting more and more conservative. We began as an online archive. We were also looking at the issue of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in terms of its propagation of the war agenda. A lot of us are anti-war activists, for instance. We were looking at hate crimes legislation, which a lot of gay people tend to think is a good thing, when in fact simply increases the prison industrial complex by demanding higher penalties for certain crimes and so on. So it was an online archive on these three topics, and then we began getting a lot of responses from people who were really appreciative of having this archive online, but who also then wanted to have a more portable version of our archive, you know, so in the form of a book. And that's really what happened, is that, you know, Ryan and a few of us got together, and we put that into motion. We contacted people whose essays we had archived online. It's a self-funded project entirely, and by that I mean Ryan Conrad's many credit cards. and we self-published it. We were very concerned about keeping the cost low, so the book is only $8 plus a little for shipping. And we were very concerned about making it very accessible, because we don't believe that queers only live in urban areas, for instance. So we wanted to keep the price low. We didn't want to depend only on technology. And we've been touring. The book tour just started about a week or so ago. Ryan is currently here in Chicago. And the response has been tremendous. We've had so many people come up to us and say, I thought I was the only crazy person out there who had a real problem with this gay marriage agenda. And it's so fantastic to see that other people think the way I or my friends do. And we've been having community discussions. We just had one in the Chicago Public Library, again affirming our commitment to making this a public conversation that cuts across borders of sexuality. We didn't want to do it in a lesbian bookstore or a queer radical space. We wanted it in the public library. We had a crowd of over 40 people, nearly 50, and we had community network TV there. It was a fantastic conversation where people really seemed to feel relieved that they were able to talk and articulate this critique of the gay movement, in a public forum. And it's been really wonderful, and we're really looking forward to we'll be doing two more books at least, one on hate crimes legislation and another on DADT. And we've also, I should add, we've also seen attempts by some gays to squash dissent. Ryan spoke at the University of Richmond, for instance, last week, and the Alumni Association sent out, some people from the Alumni Association were extremely angry, and we've had various attempts to shut down our presentations and so on. Of course, those haven't succeeded, but it just tells you how much rank conservatism there really is in the gay movement, one that pretends to be so progressive. But more importantly, I think, you were talking about all the issues I take on in terms of neoliberalism and so on, and we really do see gay marriage as very much a part of this intense privatization that characterizes neoliberalism in the world today, which is to say the idea that the state has no responsibility, apparently, to take care of people and give them basic benefits like health care, that everything should fall on the shoulders of the already embattled family. And that's really what, I'm so glad you raised the issue of neoliberalism, because I'm sure people are wondering, well, what does gay marriage have to do with that? This is just about love between two people. But really, gay marriage is a political issue for us, precisely because of its connections to neoliberalism.
Well, then this is sort of an interesting segue, because, this book is really, it really seems to be a nice example of many things. The importance of digital media, but the limitations of digital media, the importance of maintaining print, of having something in people's hands, a way for folks to exchange information, to share that information in a way face to face. The book is being used to not just kind of sell from some, you know, well, of course, people can buy it online, but but also the tour that you've mentioned means that people will gather as a community and as a group around this thing. So part of the importance of doing this was also to kind of navigate the limitations of online organizing or movement building, which the notions of those things have been very much challenged.
I also
want to make sure we talk a little bit about, you know, the book, the creation of the book, because this was, as you said, this was, you know, privately supported, because that's sort of what we face right now, but with the intent to really bring something out into the public that has been very much, as you said, squashed. These ideas are not getting play as regularly as the big three of marriage, military, and prisons.
Go ahead, sorry.
So, no, I just thought you could maybe talk a little bit more about this creation of this book and the involvement of other artists and what it sort of takes to kind of self-publish something at this point in time.
Well, besides, yes, you know, as Ryan says, apply for as many credit cards as you can and apply often. and he's, you know, he's in debt as a result of the book. I mean, but it's been really marvelous because, you know, we were profoundly aware that the technology we had, like Facebook, right, the internet, Facebook, was incredibly liberating in one sense. It put us in touch with each other. A lot of people were surprised in Chicago, for instance, when we did the presentation the day before yesterday, that we had only met for the first time this week. Ryan came into town on the 8th, and that was the first time we ever met. So we've been working on this very intensively and very collaboratively for a year, but we've never actually met before that in person. So, you know, that speaks to the nature of what we can use the technology for. But there are also limits to that. You know, you can't really incite a revolution. I think people tend to think that Twitter is can foment revolution, and it really doesn't. It's a tool. It can only be a tool. It really cannot be the revolution itself. And, you know, in terms of what it takes to get a book self-published, a lot of it is a tremendous amount of faith and a tremendous amount of trust in each other. And I think what the existence of this book speaks to is that you have this small collective of people who are in places quite far flung from each other. You know, someone's in California, someone's in Canada, in Montreal, I'm in Chicago, Ryan's in Lewiston, Maine, all over the place, New York City. You know, but that we had a tremendous amount of faith, we had a tremendous amount of passion about our cause, that we do see this as a cause, we see this as a big issue that is really threatening the lives of millions of people, really, you know, in this country, in Canada, in many places where gay marriage is taking such priority. But I think the issue of faith and trust in each other really has come through in the creation of this book. And that speaks a lot also, I think, to the potential for radical politics. That radical politics it comes through in those kinds of moments of blind faith. You know, when you decide that what matters most is this political project that you're all engaged in. And obviously, it's not like none of us knew each other at all. We all sort of had, you know, circles intersecting and so on. So nobody was completely blindsided by anybody else as a result of that. But it takes a tremendous amount of faith. It takes a tremendous amount of, I think, conviction in radical politics, which I don't think comes about, say, in a more conservative kind of politics where everything is, you know, mandated perhaps by a board and it's a very top-down hierarchical organization. So I would say, you know, the creation of this book, the fact that it's self-funded, the fact that it's pushed together by a collective of people, many of whom don't really know each other, you know, as best friends or anything like that, speaks to the potential for radical politics and what radical politics must look like.
So in our last, we have about 20 seconds here, I want to make sure folks know where they can go to find the book. And that it's it's $8. It's a fabulous book, a collection of lots of writings over the years.
It's a wonderful dense collection for $8. You can get it either on AK Press, they are our distributor, and you can go to their catalog online, or you can go to www.againstequality.org.
Okay.
And yes, and it's a fantastic gift. Thank you, everyone. Support KBOO.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Denise.
Yeah, thank you, Yasmin Nair, Chicago-based writer and activist. Thanks for joining us.
Now, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, you do hear movie reviews unlike any others. Here's an example. This week's movie moles are Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, and they went to see the new Oliver Stone movie, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement, here to talk with Jan Hocken about Oliver Stone's Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. The sequel to Stone's 1987 Wall Street, the quasi-historical fiction film is set during 2008, inside and at the start of the financial crisis. Loosely following the two crashes, the film focuses on the professional conflict of Jacob Moore, a hotshot investment banker played by Shia LaBeouf, and Bretton Woods, the CEO of an investment bank played by Josh Brolin, as well as the family drama of Jacob, his fiancée Winnie, and her father, the notorious and ostensibly reformed Gordon Gekko. Now, a lot of people have been disappointed with this film, Jan. Why do you think?
Well, there are expectations that he delivers something interesting because we're still in the midst of a horrible crisis and Oliver Stone takes up social issues. And it failed to deliver like Wall Street itself. You know, there are a lot of Hollywood derivatives operating and circulating in this film that don't deliver the content. But I do think each of these films registers important differences from the 1980s and now. So perhaps if we look at them as registering or reflecting different eras in Wall Street.
It is. I remember in the first one that the idea of inside trading and of simply being nefarious with these financial devices struck everyone as who would do that. But in this film, even though people give lip service to that attitude, it seems they expect it much more and that's simply how the system works.
And in the first film, Wall Street, there was real moral conflict. And of course, that can be misleading to have a film where you have traders undergoing a horrible crisis of conscience and the system continues on, often unrelated to those crises of conscience. But the Charlie Sheen character, the young aspiring trader, his father was doing real work and he came out of a world with real work. His father was a union leader, and there was a real kind of moral tragic dilemma at the center of the film as he betrayed his father, the world of workers that was as this company was being bought and broken into pieces. And there was no savior in that film. At the end, he goes to jail. And here we have the most, with the second one, the most sentimental ending in memory around these kinds of films with reconciliation with family, really displacing the horrible economic crisis itself.
I think that in the second film, there is a bit of that. Well, when Lou Zabel commits suicide.
And he was the head of the company that.
Yeah, the investment firm where Jacob Moore was originally employed. When he commits suicide, that's a personal affront to Jake, but it's still kind of a technical problem for him. He has to make up for that, but he becomes fixated back on making money and chasing his ideal of cold fusion or whatever.
Yeah, and the offered resolution to the financial crisis is a technological fix. And so you have in the second one the kind of resolution with family as Gordon Gekko comes out of jail and redeems himself more or less with his daughter, and the fact that he's been a hustler and made obscene amounts of money tricking people isn't really what bothers the daughter. It's more that he hasn't been a good father to her brother. So it's a very, very narrow, melodramatic scene. But in the first film, Wall Street is very seductive and very destructive as a system. And there's, I think, more of that in the first film. This one, the main character kind of skirts, he kind of makes it all work at the end, even though there's a nonprofit company that's doing something and a technological fix offered as the new bubble or the new way money's going to be made in Wall Street. It's still shuffling things around, and you don't have a sense in this new film that there's a real structural crisis.
No, and Gordon Gekko in the second film even affirms that inescapability of the world as we now know it. that we are stuck with these financial devices. We are stuck with these fictional values dominating a world of production, which isn't even present in the film, like you point out, but that we can't even think about that world of production anymore because this is all that matters, is moving the money, making the investments, imagining the financial devices. Even at one point, Jake, he affirms the validity of credit default swap or whatever. He says that it's valid. It's just the execution of it that has been improper, and that we can still use these, we just have to be decent and straightforward about them.
It's an interesting moment in the film, Money Never Sleeps, where the Greco character was talking with Jake. He says, money never sleeps, she never lets go of you. You have, that she doesn't have to sleep. And there's a feminizing of the market itself and the circulation of capital, which was, I think, and intended to tap into something about male anxiety around the seduction of money, that it becomes eroticized, that it becomes sexualized, that there is, it's like a jealous lover that won't let you go. And I think that projection onto the financial market suggests something about the way in which the whole libidinal economy of capitalism becomes organized around money making. And by the end of the film, you have this sense of this guy being redeemed, and it's not clear whether his redemption relates to the redemption of the system as a whole, whether the world they inhabit is will just keep going anyway, that there will always be predators and predatory practices. And there is a kind of cynicism, I think, more in this film, and I think an excessive fascination with the wealthy, and also making them seem much smarter than they are. On the one hand, they didn't know what they were doing. On the other hand, you see all this kind of magical wizardry.
And I even think that cynicism is a bit ambivalent, because at the beginning of the film and then towards the end, you have this voiceover that isn't anything to do with the plot, but it's this kind of abstract commentary on the Cambrian explosion and how human beings they come out of that as a good investment from the Cambrian explosion, and that they try and naturalize these processes to simply say that this is how
it's evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm personally not waiting for Wall Street 3, but there are some other films apparently documentaries on Wall Street that perhaps we can talk about on a future movie mall.
Well, this has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken talking about Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, which is still playing in theaters.
So we're going to wrap up this edition of The Old Mole, but I want to announce that a regular participant, somebody who's been interviewed on our show and will be again, a sports writer, Dave Zirin, is going to be in Portland this weekend on Sunday to participate in a panel about the contradiction between budget cuts to public schools and the $30 billion that have been spent recently in recent years on big sports stadiums. This panel is going to be at Portland State University this Sunday at 3 o'clock in Smith Memorial Union, room 228. We'll have a link to that also on the Old Mole's website. So you are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, and just want to let you know that we're going to be back next week with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. And if you'd like to hear any of today's show again, it will be available at the KBOO website later today or sometime tomorrow. Just go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. There you'll find links to previous shows. You'll find links to many of the people and their websites that we have been talking about on today's show. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Bob McChesney for their discussion of the root causes of our Great Recession, which, by the way, linked in nicely with the discussion on More Talk Radio earlier with Marty Hart Landsberg. Also, I want to thank Denise Morris and Yasmin Nair for their discussion of the myth of inclusion and the work that Yasmin is doing around that. And also to our movie moles, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, for their review of Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Joe Clement.